This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. How much does evidence, including economic evidence, matter when it comes to formulating public policy? Nobel Prize-winning economist, New York Times columnist, and Trump administration critic Paul Krugman worries that too often there is no reasoning with people of varying political persuasions. His new book is just out. It is called Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. Dr. Krugman, greetings.
Good to be here.
So tell me about these zombies. They're not people that you don't agree with. The zombies are ideas that you would have thought were dead but keep popping back up?
Yeah. A zombie is an idea that it should have been killed by evidence and just keeps on shambling along, eating people's brains. And the ultimate zombie, the one that you see most often, is the one that tax cuts pay for themselves. And then there's conventional wisdom, what I call very serious people, who will latch onto some belief, like deficits are threatening the future of the country in the midst of a deep recession, and don't seem to want to listen to the evidence that says it's not true.
On that point about deficits, right, you talk about this in the book quite a bit, but isn't it also true that while economists argue that higher deficits may be useful when the economy is in the tank, sometimes that level of spending sticks and the economy recovers and we keep spending. Maybe that's the problem people are complaining about.
Well, that's something that could be a problem. I'm not going to say that deficits never matter. They matter a lot less than people think. And the fact of the matter was that we had this sort of huge deficit obsession in 2010, 2011 with 9% unemployment. Deficits were the last thing we should have been worrying about then. And now we have deficits, and somehow the same people who were all deficits are a disaster in 2011 are kind of quiet now that we have the, you know, equally large deficits at a time of full employment.
What you conclude from that is that somehow you're not really debating the evidence about deficits, that something else is playing.
You hope. I mean, I got to believe that the evidence matters somewhere, somehow, that you're going to convince at least a few people and move the debate. But sure, the Platonic idea that having the correct ideas will persuade important people and that's how policy gets made doesn't bear a whole lot of relationship to the reality that we live in.
You write that the media is partly to blame. Part of it is something you refer to as both sidesism, the journalistic impulse to present the other side of the story. You think that can be a disservice?
Oh, it has been, very definitely. Some of it's gotten better, but it still happens quite a lot. You know, one guy says, look, here's 100 years of data and physical models and so on, and climate change is really happening and it's scary. And there's some other guy who says, no, it's all a gigantic hoax created by a vast international conspiracy of scientists. And news reports treat the two guys as being equally credible.
It is complicated as a practical matter. I can find lots of economists who think a carbon tax is a great idea, put a price on carbon dioxide so it's not free to release into the atmosphere. But I can find some legit economists who don't like a carbon tax. They'll be principled people. There may not be as many of them. And I would be tempted to put that person also into a story about a carbon tax.
Yeah, although I think you would find it very, very hard to find an economist who doesn't think we should have some policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I cannot think of anyone who isn't essentially a paid flack for the fossil fuel industry who doesn't believe we should be doing something like that. So there are disputes about tactics, but disputes about the fundamental need for a policy, there isn't any real dispute.
A top story for us over the last year has to be the trade story, the trade war and the response. Now, you are a world expert on trade. It's one of your contributions to the economics discipline. But you think the trade issue is overblown?
My professional, you know, I've got a lot of personal human capital invested in trade because that's what I did. That's what the I got the Swedish thingy for.
The Swedish thingy.
But look, trade is for the U.S. It's about the same. We spend about the same share of our income on imports that we spent on healthcare. And if you ask, you know, which of those markets is most screwed up? Clearly, healthcare is vastly more screwed up than trade. So what we do with healthcare is much more important than what we do with trade. In a way, trade is not that big an issue because we've had 60 years of pretty good policy on trade. And it's only in the last couple of years that we've gone slightly crazy. So it's overrated as an issue.
I mean, but our livelihoods are connected to jobs, which are so connected to trade. You wouldn't say it's a bigger issue?
Well, some of them are. Two-thirds of what we produced. Two-thirds of the jobs are stuff that is really not traded at all. It isn't even traded between cities. It's local stuff. It's local services. And so there's only a relatively narrow base of stuff that is actually, you know, part of international trade. And a fair bit of that is actually still is pretty much unencumbered. So trade is, it's a big deal, but it's not as big a deal as people want it to be, because they like to talk, you know, global only. They like to talk about big, sweeping international stuff.
Yeah, but surely even before the Trump administration, trade wasn't this well-oiled machine. I mean, we didn't retrain people as well as we should have in the face of globalization, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. There were certainly disruptions. I mean, the surge of imports from China certainly disrupted some communities, some industries. If you're a furniture maker in Hickory, North Carolina, then you suddenly found the bottom drop out of your local economy. Of course, that happens for lots of reasons. It's not just trade that does that. If you were a traditional coal miner, the replacement of traditional coal mining with mountaintop removal, where you just blow the tops off mountains, also disrupted the economy. So trade clearly was one source of disruption, but it's not clear that it deserves as much weight relative to other things.
Trying to pick up from cues in the book about using evidence to explore important issues, and one that we have been spending a lot of time on is about automation,
right,
and its effect in the workplace. What about this idea, the end of work? Is that a zombie idea, the end of work?
It is kind of a zombie idea, because if it was really true that robots were doing all the things that people used to do, then we should be seeing output per person really soaring, right? The remaining people ought to be producing stuff, a lot of stuff per person employed. That's productivity. And what we're actually seeing is a period of very slow growth in productivity. So if robots are doing all of this stuff, why don't we see it in the numbers? What I would say is there are always jobs that are being displaced by machines. There used to be hundreds of thousands of longshoremen around New York, right? And now there's just a handful of gigantic cranes in Elizabeth, New Jersey with a dozen people operating them. We don't think of that so much. What we notice is that robots, some of this artificial intelligence takes jobs that people like you and me, people who push words and symbols around for a living, used to do. And that hits us harder. But it's not at all clear that this is any faster than it used to be.
Here's the problem. As we try to craft public policy to think about the changes that will happen, it's hard to find a serious economist who says there's not going to be a decent amount of disruption. I mean, maybe net in the end we'll get better and more jobs.
There's always disruption. You can't protect people from change. There's always going to be something happening. It's not clear that there are that many fewer people employed in retail than there were in the past, but the kinds of people and where they are has changed. So instead of there's fewer brick and mortar stores, and then there's 150,000 Amazon employees in distribution centers someplace else. And so that kind of thing is always happening. But what you can try to do is you can try to create an economy where it's painful, but it's not catastrophic, where you don't lose your health care, where you don't find yourself without adequate nutrition. You know, when change happens, there is a pretty high safety net. And, you know, most other advanced countries have done a much better job of doing that than we have.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. His latest book is called Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. Dr. Krugman, thank you.
Thank you.